Hi, everybody. My name is Bud McDonald, and I am an alcoholic. Now, you notice I gave my last name, and I violated the tradition of anonymity, inasmuch as it's my... I'm allowed to do this. I can do it. But don't nobody put it in the paper or take a picture of me or anything like that. If you do, you're crazy anyway, you know, to break the camera. I didn't know until just a little while ago that I was going to be here talking to you folks. I figured I'd get to see some meetings down here. My home group is the Hole in the Ground in Huntington Park, California. That's in Los Angeles County. And it was the oldest group in the world meeting in the same room. It lacked 2 months of being 60 years. And we ran it the way we wanted to. We had four secretaries in 60 years. Like I say, we ran it the way we wanted to. A guy named Tex Adams started the group in 1941. And when he started the group, he had joined the mother group in Los Angeles. There were about 15 guys sober in AA in Los Angeles. The Saturday Evening Post article by Jack Alexander had just gotten out, and New York was flooded with letters from people wanting to know about this thing that Alexander had reported on. He was going to expose this clique that they had, this sinful thing that what they were doing with drunks or whatever it was. But they started that thing, and Tex Adams found out about it. His sister, Sybil, was the first woman in Alcoholics Anonymous in the West Coast. A gal named Marty Mann was in New York, and two other women in Akron, Ohio. They didn't think women could be drunks, you know, couldn't be alcoholics. But Sybil wrote a letter to New York after this article in the Saturday Evening Post magazine, wanting to know where it was, and she would come there if they would, because she had a real bad drinking problem. And they wrote her back and said, well, there's a small group in Los Angeles meeting at the Cecil Hotel on Friday nights. And so she gets her husband to take her down there on this Friday night, and they met and talked to the people, and then the guy that was leading the meeting says, as is the custom, the women will have to go meet in the kitchen, because we are only alcoholics here. And Sybil was crushed, and her husband, who was a non-alcoholic, never had two short beers in his life, was subjected to this AA meeting that these guys had. So anyway, Sybil got a hold of the guy, is a milkman out in Whittier, and called him and says, send your AA ambulance after me. I need, well, you know. But he told her to come back the following Friday night, and he'd make sure she got into the meeting. And she did, and met these people, and by this time a lot of stuff was coming to Los Angeles from the General Service, or it was just the Central Office in New York at that time. And they had this big box of mail of people writing wanting to know about help, and there was a whole bunch of them from women that had drinking problems. And Frank Randall, that was leading the group at that time, says, we have a woman alcoholic now, and we have these letters for women with problems, and we're going to turn them over to Sybil, and we put Sybil in charge of the drunken women. And Sybil had never been in charge of anything, and she could see flashbacks. Sybil's in charge. But anyway, she went out and began to make some calls on people, and one of the guys she called on was her brother, Tex Adams, who was a labor broker down on Skid Row. And he used to have the walking man that would go and throw papers on people's front porch, you know, and stuff like that. And so he gathered up a bunch of his drunks and went down there to find out what this scam was. There had to be some money to be made someplace in this thing. And so old Tex, he went down there and he found out there was no money to be made in it, but he did find out that it helped him with his drinking problem, and he paid attention to these guys, and he never had a drink from that day till the day he died. And that was some 11 years after that he died. But old Tex, he started the Hole in the Ground group accidentally. He wanted to say something one night, and Randall told him, shut up, you don't know nothing. And you sit down and Tex says, to hell with you, and out he walked. And he said, I'll start my own group. They says, you can't do that, you'll wreck AA. He said, watch me. And so he went down to Walnut Park, which is a little town in southeast LA, and they had their first meeting in a guy named Walter Watt in his living room. And there were about six or seven guys there in this meeting in Sybil. It was kind of funny. Oh, Tex was leading the meeting, and he says, "All right, we're going to close the meeting now with the Lord's Prayer. Sib, recite the Lord's Prayer with us." And she says, "I didn't know it." You know, and that's kind of ridiculous because we hear the Lord's Prayer all the time. But she didn't know the Lord's Prayer. But anyway, they started that group. And they sat in a little place at the end of the J car line, a streetcar switch around there. And this is where they located. And that building caught fire the night before the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor in 1941, December the 7th. And so that night they rented the place where the Hole in the Ground finally established itself. And it was at the old Ebell Club in Huntington Park at the corner of Clarendon and Malabar. They started these meetings, and it began to grow. And then some guy would get mad at Tex about something and say, "You can't do it this way, Tex." They say, "To hell with you. Here's a book and a pound of coffee. Go start your own meeting. Don't answer with me." And so more meetings in Southern California were started as Hate the Hole in the Ground, as anything could be. And so this is what how it began in Southern California. The group was, Tex died in November of 1942 or 52, and he gave the keys to a man named Duke Carson and appointed him secretary. No election, no nothing, just he appointed him secretary. And so Duke was an old ex-convict at Leavenworth Penitentiary. He used to smuggle Chinese into the United States when it was profitable to do so, you know, and I think Tom Murphy that was around there one day, and he was applying for a job, and he was filling out this application, and he put Duke down as a personal reference, and it says occupation, and Murphy wrote down Oriental Importer. So this Chinese smuggler, he took over as the secretary of the group. I arrived there March 10th, 1953, and I came in out of jail. Now, I'd been in reform school. I remember when my brothers were going to high school, I was going to reform school. And when they were going to college, I was going to prison. And so our lives were a little bit different. I was the town horse's ass, you know. And but I read the book, Alcoholics Anonymous in Jail, and I had met a guy that was in AA just briefly, and he looked and sounded just like a drunk that I used to drink with, one of my drinking buddies. And he wasn't an alcoholic, couldn't be, you know, because he drank like me, and I wasn't an alcoholic. You know? And so anyway, this guy, I listened to him, and I got out of jail on that Monday, March 10th, 1953. And I thought, got home, my wife picked me up down to the LA County Jail, and we went down to her folks' place where they were kind enough to allow me to stay after being in all kinds of trouble again. And I got out, I had a 10-year-to-life sentence hanging over my head. I had to make restitution about $9,700 that I'd stolen, and I didn't know where the hell I was going to get that kind of money or anything. But I thought I better call some of my friends and let them know I'm back on the bricks. And I couldn't think of a living soul that wanted to hear from me. My mother wouldn't allow me in her home, wouldn't allow me anywhere around there. I'd stolen from her so many times that there's no hope there. My brothers wanted nothing to do with me. I'd clipped and clouted them in every direction, and they'd had all they could handle of this child, you know. And I thought, well, I'll call Alcoholics Anonymous. And I looked it up in the phone book. I flopped a big L.A. phone book that thick open. And it opened right to Alcoholics Anonymous in the Southeast. And I don't know, maybe that was an omen or something, but I called, and a guy who later became a very dear friend of mine, old Joe Penter, we called him Alabama, he was little old wine oak in Alabama, but he knew more multisyllable words than anybody I ever heard. He could make he could make asking for a cigarette sound like a major speech or something. But old Alabama, I told him, I said, just got out of jail. And he said, have you had a drink yet? And I thought, that has got to be the dumbest question I have ever been asked. I'm calling AA. And I said, no. And he said, well, you better get your ass over here. Now that, you know, they need me right now. It's I better hurry and get over here. So I go over there, and my wife and I, and we listen to what these people had to say. And everybody was trying to impress each other with how bad they were. You know, the more evil things you had done, the more status you had in Alcoholics Anonymous. And kind of sounded like, can you top this? But they said they had a meeting there that night, and it was called a beginner's meeting, that I should come back to that meeting. And so I came back that night, and a guy named Jim Farwell was leading the meeting. Jim died a couple of years ago with 54 years of sobriety. And old Jim Farwell was leading the meeting, and I didn't know what the scam was. I knew there had to be some hook someplace in there for these people to get this bunch of people around. And this was in hard times. It was Dwight Eisenhower was the president of the United States, and it was kind of a semi-depression. And there were a lot of guys hanging around that place, and a lot of tall tales that you heard and everything else. But I went back to that meeting, and I heard this Jim Farwell talking, and he was a tall, thin man, very well educated. You could tell by the way he talked that he was well educated and knew what the hell he was talking about. And old Farwell told a little of the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, how Bill and Bob met and their connection with each other. And he made sense, and I thought that he was being paid to be there, to be at their meeting. And then they took up a collection, and I knew he was being paid. You know? That's where the money had to go. But I listened to what he had to say. I heard guys tell some big whizzers that I couldn't believe, you know. But there was one guy, this old Duke Carson, the Chinese smuggler. He talked about sitting on the edge of the bed at 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning wondering, what in the hell is the matter with you? Why do you do it? And you can't stand the guilt. You can't stand the pain. And I was doing all right. I was drinking beer. And Joe bought me a double shot. Well, God damn it, every time I drink beer and whiskey, I'll go off the deep end. I'm not even out of the jam I'm in. I'm planning the next one, because the next time will be different. I won't drink beer and whiskey. And I'm planning the next one. And so I was attracted by that. And I came back to the meetings and listened to what they said. And I got the book and reread it and tried to study it and tried to find out what it meant. And a lot of it confused me. And there was a lot of talk about God in there, and I didn't believe in God. I was agnostic. I didn't have guts enough to deny the existence of a supreme being, but I couldn't see where there was one. And I didn't have the guts enough to say there wasn't, though, so I chose to be an agnostic for a long, long time. But I kept going to the meetings and listening to what these people had to say. Like I say, I had this big restitution bill I had to pay. I had never paid anybody anything at any time. A banker financed a car for me one time, and my folks, he was a friend of theirs, and because of their friendship, he financed his car, and they found it about 8 months later with the rear end out of it, marked parts in someplace at the curb, Bell Gardens or someplace, you know. And I owed him, and I owed everybody that I could think of. And I can't find a job. I'm blackballed in the trucking industry. I was a truck driver, drove long line trucks. And other than doing time in jails and prisons, I was in the Marine Corps in World War II. And I came out of the Marine Corps in October 1943. And I went and had Christmas dinner in San Quentin Prison in California. And I, thank you. I'd like to tell you some big John Dillinger story about what a badass I was when it come to time to go to prison, but what actually happened, I'm out drunk with some buddies of mine, and one of them had a gun, and we ran out of money, and a market was there, and that looked like a good place to borrow some money with that gun, you know. And so we did, and as we fled the scene, the guy that was driving the car, he was drunk, the drunkest one of the five of us. He ran a boulevard stop sign, and the cops started chasing us. We're running the boulevard stop sign, and we knew we were caught. They didn't even know the goddamn market had been robbed yet, and you know, and this is how we're getting caught. And so anyway, we stop, and Jimmy Goff, the guy that had the money and the gun, took out running. And they nailed him and nailed the rest of us. And, of course, I didn't know any better. I pled guilty and got a public defender. Public defenders are the best friends that the county attorney or the city attorney has. They can turn a guy around real quick, like. But anyway, they sent me to prison, and I did 3.5 years and got out. Never straightened out completely, still drinking. First thing I did was get a jug when I got out, and went right back to the same way of living I was living before, in trouble and everything. I was married to my second wife when I got busted on a big restitution thing. But my first wife divorced me while I was in prison. And things were pretty bleak and down, like, and it wasn't any heroic big shot deal at all. It was just a stupid bunch of gunsels that we didn't know what the hell we were doing, you know. I went to jail a second time for robbery. I held up the Southern California Gas Company. Now, they have money there, because people used in those days, they didn't send checks or have credit cards or anything like that. They'd pay in cash. And so they always had a lot of cash. And that's where this $9,700 came from. And I got caught on that deal. But I hired an attorney. And he got me out of this particular jam. And got me probation and restitution and all this kind of stuff. When I got out of jail, I was looking for work, and I had all kinds of things happen. Things would begin to look good, and then they'd turn bad, and then all at once they'd look good again, and I wouldn't know exactly what the hell was happening. But I wasn't drinking. I had read the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and gone to that first meeting, and I continued to go to the hole in the ground and listen to what these people had to say. And things... I stayed sober in spite of myself. I really, you know, because most of my thinking was I got a drink and make things all right, you know. But I listened to what these guys said, and I was 2 years and 5 days on the program and staying sober and got a steady job, not knowing I was going to be a steady job when I... Not knowing I was going to get a job, it just so happened one Saturday night my wife and I were going to the movies, and we were going to the cheapy movie, the 15 or 20 cent movie, I forget what it was, but we're standing in line, and the guy that I used to work for was standing right behind us in line. And I didn't know, when I quit him, I challenged him to come outside and fight and all this kind of stuff, you know. Really left a good impression, you know. You could go back. But anyway, we were talking, and he says, "I understand you don't drink anymore." And I had a reputation of being one of the wildest drunks in the trucking business. And I said, "No, I haven't had a drink for a year." He said, "Well, good for you. Guys like you shouldn't drink." And I thought, "Up yours, you know." But I continued to stay sober, and coincidentally, 1 year later, I'm standing in that same line in that same theater, and this guy and his wife are standing behind me. It was a Friday night, and I had just finished a job that day. I'm going to be out looking for another job. I'd been doing carpenter work at the time. Couldn't get a job driving truck because I couldn't give any kind of a reference. And this guy's standing in line again. He says, "You're still sober?" And I says, "Yeah." He says, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm out of a job. I just finished a job today, but I'm going to be looking Monday. He said, why don't you come by me? And he said, I got four trucks now. He had one when I worked for him before. And he says, come on by my place and talk to me. And I did, and he put me to work. I went out on a truck that night, and I retired from that company 30 years later as general manager of the outfit, and couldn't tell you how it happened other than I didn't drink one day at a time. And things turned around, and slowly but surely I began to make a little progress, and things were, the goose hang high, you know, but things were pretty good. And I'm going to a lot of meetings, and I'm finding out what makes me stay sober. And it was working with younger people and other people. When I say younger, I don't mean in age, but they were newer than me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And old Duke was the secretary of the Hole in the Ground at that time, the Chinese smuggler. And he would have me haul him around, so, hey, bud, what are you doing tomorrow afternoon? Well, I don't know. I think he could come take me over to court. I got to go see the judge about something. And he knew all the judges around there, and he was a real con man of the worst kind, you know. And so he could get anybody to take him over there, but he said, bud, I want you to do it. And I would go, and I'd take him, and I got to meeting judges. And I used to be scared of judges, you know. I'd get up in front of them, and they'd find me guilty and fine me or put me in jail or whatever. And I didn't like judges too well. But I would do whatever he told me, and by doing this, I met these judges, and I began to gain a little of their confidence. Time went by, and I'm staying sober, I'm working hard, I'm gone from driving truck, I'm in sales, and then I'm in the top management of the company, and these guys are treating me real well in the business. The judges are treating us well, giving lots of drunks probation. We started the court cards that they're universal now. Everybody, every court has them all over the country and all over the world, I do believe. But Judge Emerson and I started that. But I had things going just so good for me. I bought a house, got my wife satisfied. We got another baby in the house, and things are looking pretty good, all because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I tried to take the credit for it, and I couldn't. It was you people, you know, and the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I began to understand what the 12 steps meant and what they meant to me. I looked at that first step, admitted I was powerless over alcohol, that my life had become unmanageable. Well, all I had to think of is any one of the many times that I'd stopped to have a drink or two on my way home and wind up drunk against my own better judgment and not know why. I'd wind up drunk against, not intended to, all I was going to do is stay sober. And so that kind of showed me that I didn't know how to handle alcohol. There was something I was missing, because other people kept their jobs and they kept things going their own way. And I couldn't do that. My life was unmanageable. I couldn't pay bills. I couldn't keep a job. I divorced my first wife. My brothers wouldn't speak to me. You know, all this kind of stuff was happening. And so I knew that I didn't know the first thing about managing my life. And that second step says, came to believe that a power greater than herself could restore us to sanity. Well, the insanity they talk about is that crazy idea when you're sitting on the edge of the bed wondering why do you do it? You're drinking beer and Joe Boy to the double shot, and you went off the deep end again. The next time I'm drinking beer and whiskey, I'm not out of the jam I'm in, and I'm planning the next one. You know, that's nutty. Bill in the book talks about the jaywalker. This guy is a compulsive jaywalker. And he gets out in the middle of the street, and somebody knocks him on his ass one day. He gets all healed up, and my God, he's back out there jaywalking again. And he gets knocked down again. Gets healed up, and he's back out jaywalking again. That guy is crazy. He's not a jaywalker. He's insane. And that's what they're talking about in it, that came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. The only power greater than me that I knew of was a prison guard or a cop or somebody with a you know, some kind of a financial hold over me, like a boss or somebody like that. That was a power greater than myself. But when I put the plug in the jug and just kept it in there, things began to get better. I didn't have to sit on the edge of the bed wondering why. And I might begin to straighten my life out a little bit. And we were still trying to pay off all this restitution that I owed and everything else. So I changed the third step a little bit. I made a decision to turn my life, my will, and my paycheck over to the care of my wife. And by God, the bills got paid, you know. And slowly but surely, these things began to happen. I looked at that fourth step in the book, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. And I asked Duke, what the hell does that mean? And he said, well, you know, anything is morally wrong. He said, you ever done anything that you're ashamed of that you don't want to tell anybody else about, that you think it's that dumb? I said, yeah. He said, write it down. So I wrote it down, you know. And then I found some other things that I didn't like about me and things that I'd done. And I wrote them down. Some of them were financial amends, some were apologies, some were that I couldn't make amends for, but other than to just be right about what I'm doing now, these were the good things. And so I knew what that fourth step meant, and Duke and I sit in the shade of a pepper tree over in Walnut Park, California, in my old 1937 Chevy. And I had this notebook pad, and he's batting it on his knee there. He had cataracts at the time. Maybe that's why I picked him to be my sponsor, because he couldn't read, you know. But we talked about what I'd written in there. And I evaluated the things that I could do something about then and try to make amends for the things that I'd done. That's what the fifth step says. Admitted to God, ourselves, and another human being the exact nature of these wrongs. And I talked to Duke about it, and he steered me the right way, because I began to make some amends, and I began to forgive myself as well as other people forgiving me for the things that I'd done. My older brother and I didn't speak for 8 years. He hated my guts, and I hated his. He was so narrow-minded, I stole a credit card of his and went to Florida and back home. He couldn't see the fun in that. I stole his golf clubs and sold those, but he couldn't prove it. But he had given up on me. But I eventually ran into him. This was about 4 years after I was sober, and told him, Don, I got your name on a list of people I've harmed, and I owe you some amends. And he said, Bud, you don't owe me nothing. Mom tells me you're sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm just tickled to death that you're like you are. You keep doing what you're doing. And I thought he hated me, and he loved me all the time, you know. And that fourth and fifth steps made that possible. My kid brother and I made up for a lot of things. I made some little petty things that bothered me. I would have got $27 in the service station for charging gasoline there. And the guy had been a friend of mine, and I owe him this money, and I can't drive through the intersection of that service station without feeling guilty. So I went to him and paid him the $27 and told him why. And it made him happier than hell to get the $27, but to renew my friendship. And I could buy gas in his station again. He wouldn't give me credit, but I could give, you know. But I could buy the gas there, you know. And so that was part of making those amends. And the humbly asked God to help me remove these character defects, you know, was another thing I had to... I became entirely ready to do it, and I was ready to do anything I'm supposed to be ready for, you know. But doing them is another thing. And to humbly ask God for help to do something I didn't seem to be able to do for myself was a tough one for me. But I found I got in a situation where I didn't know what to do. I had a guy that had been at the hole in the ground one Sunday night and talked, and I gave him my business card. I told him that if I could help him in any way, give me a call. If he decided he wanted to do something about it, he didn't think AA was for him. He's a Navy officer who had been kicked out of the Navy because of his drinking and actions and things like that. And so I gave him my card and told him to call me. You know, I left my office one day. By this time, I'm managing this trucking company. Montana, California, and we didn't have cell phones at that time. But I stopped to have lunch, and the secretary called me and said, "You better get back over here." And I said, "Who is my brother?" He's just talking to someone who's committed suicide, and he's calling you for help. So I zipped around back home and talked to the guy where he was over the South Heat, about 5 miles from where I was. And it was no use being on or even like and stuff. So I told him, "Well, hang on till I get there." I drove over to his kitchen and got there and went about. Then he hits me. This guy's got a gun. He's going to blow his brains out. And he's been drunk about, I don't know how long, a long time. And I don't know what I'm walking into. And he lived in a garage apartment upstairs over a garage. And I parked the car and I walked up there and I damn near turned around. I got halfway up the stairs because I didn't know what I was going to face. And I walked up and the screen was open. And he's a good man. I came in and had two P-Beretta pistols sitting at the coffee table in front of him. We started talking and I don't know what I said. I have no idea what I said to him or anything else. But I said to myself, I'm going to have to take a good look at what to do. And we talked. And he decided he wouldn't get any idea that he was going to do it. He didn't get it. To the military personnel. And this guy was had been kicked out of the Navy, but he'd been an officer. And I called the guy that I knew and told him, I said, I got out. He was in the Navy and he wants some help. And he don't qualify, but I got out of somewhere. And for the first time and many times that I'd been in that place, I didn't even have to stop at the guard shack on the way in. They gave me the highball and on through there I went. Went back and got him fixed that place, and by God, he got well. He got well, and I didn't have a damn thing to do with it other than be the messenger, you know, carried the drunk and carried the message. He left those two P. Beretta pistols with me when I left him at that Navy place. As I told you, I'm an ex-convict, and that's all I needed was the cops to catch me with those two pistols. I can go back to the penitentiary real good. But I took them over to a captain on the Southgate Police Department where this guy lived and gave them to him and told him who they belonged to and the whole bit. And the guy is still real active. He's still alive, and he's got 30-some years of sobriety. And it's just one of the things that happens that you don't plan for. You have no idea what to do or how to handle it, and it handles itself. And we don't know what to do about it. But that seventh and eighth step, or sixth and seventh step, become entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character and humbly ask Him to remove my shortcomings and humbly ask Him to help me. God, I don't know what to do. You're going to have to take over, you know. The eighth step made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. We used to years ago have a thing called the 12-step play. And Sybil was the one that got this thing started. And she had a guy that looked like a real executive businessman, and Leo Kelly. And he was Bill Wilson, and she'd be Ruth Hockwood, who was Bill Wilson's secretary, who typed up the transcript of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And they would pick out a guy for each step, and they would tell about that step. And then they would cast the part of Jimmy Burwell. And Jim Burwell was the guy who is responsible for Appendix 2 in the book, God as We Understand Him, and the chapter to the agnostic. He was the atheist that came in that Bill, like to drove Bill and those guys crazy in New York. But Jimmy Burwell, I got to know him. We were both on the conference committee 1 year and became a lifelong friend. I got to be a pallbearer at his funeral. He was just one hell of a guy. And so that eighth, ninth step, we would get there and Burwell would be butting in and telling me, "Yeah, you're crazy," and this, that, and the other thing. And when we got to the eighth step, this guy that got up and told how he made this list of all people he'd harmed, he became willing to make amends to them all. And then George Otañez, this little fiery Mexican, jumped up and he said, "You crazy son of a bitch, you told me to that I got to make amends to these people and everything and apologize. And he says, I told my wife, I was playing around with a gal down the hall, and she went down and told her husband, and he beat the hell out of me, and the wife left me, and all that. And he would carry on about this goddamn thing in this play. But it tells us, you know, that except when to do so would injure them or others. I can't do this to, you know, just get myself loose from this. But I can't involve the other people. I can't tell somebody something that's going to hurt them or break up their marriage or anything like that. Because that's what it means when it says, you know, except when to do so would injure them or others. We have to be careful about those things. At 10th step, I don't really like the 10th step. Well, I'm back off from that. There's one word in there I don't like. It says we continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, and here's the word I don't like, promptly admit it. I don't like to promptly admit I'm wrong about anything at any time. But I do know that no matter what, if I'm wrong, the sooner I can get rid of it, the easier it is to get rid of. And it, you know, the greatest argument stopper in the world is two words: I'm sorry. And if we do it soon enough, you can really get away with it. You know. And so I know what that 10th step means, and I have learned from that, and it's kept me out of trouble so many times. That promptly admit I'm wrong. The 11th step was a real churchy sounding step. Last time I went to church, some asshole stole my hat. I didn't want to be around those kind of people, you know. But we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Sought through prayer. Well, a prayer is nothing but a good unselfish thought, a good wish for the guy next to you. That's what a prayer is. And meditation is to direct my thinking along a positive line, get alone and quiet with me, and just meditate on what it is that's bugging me. Direct meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him. I didn't understand Him too good, but I did know there was something. And I don't know if there's God, Buddha, Shindu, Allah, or what it is, but there's something there that seems to protect me from getting in trouble. I just back off and, you know, you have to do it, God, because I don't know what to do. Everything I do is wrong. And a lot of times doing nothing is the best thing to do. And then there are other times. But there are other times that I must take some action. And when I meditate on that 11th step, I know what it's about. The 12th step, having had a spiritual awakening, is the result of these steps. And this is where I got my spiritual thinking. That there is something, there's a God, there's a Buddha or Shindu or Allah, whatever that power greater than I am is, that seems to direct me in the way I want to go. And I know what it is. I try to carry this message to alcoholics and practice these principles in all my affairs. This is what I'm doing tonight. Telling you a little bit about my story, a little bit about what has happened to me in my life and how these 12 steps have affected me. I think about my life as of March 10th, 1953, owing more money than I could ever hope to repay. I got a marriage hanging by a thread. Why my wife kept hung up on with me, I will never know. If anyone ever treated me one-tenth as badly as I did her, I would have killed him. I never physically abused her, but boys, psychologically I did. And I was that kind of an asshole. And slowly but surely, things began to change, and I began to change. I can remember some times when I thought about going back to robbing people and stuff like that, because I knew how to do that and how to get the money and stuff like that. And I learned more in the penitentiary about that than I did any place else. You know, I remember one time I was at a meeting on a Sunday night, and I'm having a hell of a time getting a job and keeping one and keeping working, and I'd been doing carpenter work and stuff. And a friend of mine that I'd done time with happened to be there, and he says, how's the work looking, bud? And I said, I've got to go out looking tomorrow. It's Monday, and I'm going to be out knocking on doors. I forgot to tell you, so I got a friend in Downey. He's a building contractor, and he's got a job for you. You go tell him that I told you to come by there, and he'll have a job for you. I go to old Johnny. He's got Bud a job. And I went home feeling good that night. Next morning, I'm out there in Downey at this guy's address, riding early, and I wake the guy up. You know, contractors usually up early anyway, but he ain't up. And I says, Johnny told me to come and see you. You had a job for me. Oh, he says, you know that crazy Johnny, how he is. Good God Almighty. And I'm thinking, oh, Christ, what am I going to do? I ain't got no job here, you know. And we talked for a little bit. And he went back in his house. And I sit out in front and thinking, what the hell am I going to do? I don't have enough money in my pocket to buy gas to get home, hardly. I don't have any cigarettes. My family is hungry. We got, I don't know where we got it, but we had a whole bunch of spaghetti. We've been eating spaghetti and oleomargarine and cheese. And that's what we've been eating for about 3 days. I got the two little babies and my wife. And I don't know what the hell I'm going to do, but I'm getting embarrassed sitting in front of his place. I fired this old Chevy of mine up and headed east or west on 3rd Street in Downey. And I got about two blocks from Old River School Road. And when I got there, it's a dead end, and I got to either turn right or left. If I turn right, I'm going home. But then I'm locked in. Got no money to get gas. Got nothing to do. And if I turn left, I'm going down to Hollydale, and I'm going to tie up with my old crime partners. And they'll know how to get some money, and they'll be using and drugging and drinking and all this kind of stuff. And about two blocks before I got there, I saw an old man digging in his front yard. This is about 7 o'clock in the morning. And I don't know why. To this day, I couldn't tell you why. But I stopped my car, backed up, said, old man, I'll take your job from you for $1 an hour. And he handed me that shovel like it was on fire. He couldn't get rid of it. And he was putting in the sprinkler system. And so I dug the lawn and set the thing aside and dug the ditch and everything, got ready for the pipe, and the pipe wasn't there yet. And I worked 7 hours, and I'm telling him what a big shot I am. I don't really need this job and everything, and I'm doing all this for you, and blah, 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 blah. But now I'm finished, and I need to collect this $7 that I've earned that day for 7 hours' work. And I got to tell the guy what a liar I've been. And I didn't like that. But I told him I don't have enough money to buy gas to get back here. So he reluctantly paid me the $7 that I had earned that day and promised him I'd be back in the morning. We'd get to putting his pipe together and everything. And he really didn't expect me to come back because I had worked real hard that day. And I got home, and my wife went and got some hamburger and some tomato paste, and we had spaghetti with some goodies in it and some French bread. Bought some cigarettes and put a couple of gallons of gas in the car. In those days, you could buy gas for about 2 bits a gallon or less. And I was in good shape going back to work. Next day, my wife fixed me a meatball sandwich. And I got back here, and we finished that job up in 11 hours, and we had that grass all replanted, and we're admiring our work, and the sprinklers are working, and it's just absolutely wonderful. And the guy handed me a $20 bill, and I said, I don't have any changes. That's all right, bud, you keep it, you've earned it. And from that day to this, I've never worried about money. I have never worried about money. God put that old man in that lawn in front of me. I had nothing to do with it. And so I know that whatever's going to happen is going to happen, and I'm going to be able to deal with it. And I don't have to drink over it. And the drinking was just the symptom of my problem. My problem was not thinking, the fear that I had all the time. The no good about myself. It's wonderful to find this program and you people and the people in it. And these people have been the best part for me. My wife, she passed away in 1996 on April 4th. And she was a beautiful, wonderful gal, my best friend. She was the best friend I ever had in my life. And we had a together. I had a daughter and a son and a wife died here. And they're good friends of mine. I flip around the world on frequent flyer miles. My son is senior vice president of Condé Nast, which is the publishing company that publishes the New Yorker magazine, Golf Digest, all kinds of stuff. They pay him a lot of money for doing that. He's well off. He's got a beautiful 8,000 square foot, two-tower brown island in Brooklyn, the Beverly Hills of Brooklyn. That's where I stopped before coming here. On his frequent flyer miles. Yeah, I don't have a lot of money, but I can fly all over the place on his frequent flyer miles. You know? And he's a good friend of mine. His daughter was raised by my wife. And she knew the difference between her mother and her mom. And her mom was the one that taught her to be a lady. And that lady is an attorney. And she's one of the finest that I know. If I ever got in trouble, I'd sure as hell want her to defend me. And she practices in Reno, Nevada, and has a beautiful home there. And I have my own room and bath at her home in Reno, Nevada. And she thinks that Alcoholics Anonymous is about that much higher than the Catholic Church and the Democratic Party combined. Think we're sober, you know. And my youngest daughter, she's a character. She tried to be a musician for a lot of years. She had a woman to rock and roll band. And she plays the saxophone, clarinet, and keyboard, and percussion instruments and everything else. And could never make it. She always had to have a second job. And so she finally decided to go back to school, and her older brother and sister put her through college and got a master's in marketing research and does that kind of stuff in sociology. And does real, real well. And she's a good friend of mine. She's the one that keeps me laughing all the time. She's a real sweetheart. And I have those people left that this woman left me with. I have the wonderful people in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I went to the international convention. Had the opportunity there. That's the first one that I ever went to. My wife and I. It was the 4th of July. And by the... I went to the anniversary. We could have built someplace on our way. The kid threw a big shindig for us. And on the 25th, the 30th, the 35th, the 40th, the 45th. But the 45th, never got there. She died before me. She died on April 4th. And our 20th anniversary would have been... I had these people. I had the love of my two brothers, who wanted nothing to do with me. My mother died at my home. I lived in the house. I put an apartment for her, and she lived there and shot because he was in this program. And my mother and I, and the love we had for each other, was restored. I had to give up a lot of my people that I knew before. I'll be on the last Friday of July. I'll be at a shindig at the high school that I got kicked out of. I hold the record of being the only guy that ever got kicked out of that high school that they never let come back. Now, they got all pissed off because I and Willie Campbell and Bob Evans locked the teacher of the gardening class in the tool shed and set fire to it. You know, of course, he got out of there without getting hurt, but they kicked us out of school and wouldn't let me go back. Those other two guys went back to school. You know.
No.
And that hurt my feelings, but on the last Friday in July, at the Gathering of Eagles, which is the Bell High School, craziest son of a bitch that ever was around there. And they still they claim they're legends, but they're just a bunch of lies they tell about me. But things that I could. But I was able to stay on a job for 30 years and retire, and it's because of you people and what I learned from you and how to live. And I didn't have to drink over any of the situations that came up. I've had drivers die on the road. I've had all kinds of things. People that are close to me that I've lost. And all the things that have happened, my mother and all the rest of these people, I've been protected and taken care of. And it's because of this program, as I say, and you people. So if I continue doing what I'm doing, I may make it to 50 years, you know. It's really easy to do. All you do is don't drink and don't die. Thank you. But I think of all the people that I've learned from and had the blessings of knowing, guys that have gone high and in Alcoholics Anonymous and other guys that have done great things in their lives, and it's because of them and because of you, because you're here listening to me tonight. Now, I don't know whether I'll see any of you again, but at the International Convention in Minneapolis last year, back in 1975, Judge Emerson and I started a place called Cider House. We rented a big building from the state on the grounds of the Metropolitan State Hospital. It's an insane asylum. We got this big building, and we started a group called Cider House. And it's a live-in, dry-and-out place, but there's a program as well as just being a sober living house. And the guys that come in there, they got 60 days to get themselves straightened out. We've upped it to 90 days for some. They get themselves straightened out. And they are able to find themselves, it seems like, in this place. We opened Cider House in March 1975, and it works, because they had the countdown. Everybody stood, and those were the years, sit down 5 years, 10 years, and everything. And then got down into the 40s, in the top 40s. And I'm still standing with about maybe 15 other people, and 56,000 people in that place. And I feel pretty good. And I'm still standing. Then I had to sit down. And as I left the place, I'm walking across the plaza. And I hear a voice. This tears me up sometimes, because I hear a guy yelling, "Hey, Bud! Hey, Bud!" And I turned around, the guy's going, "Cider House! Cider House!" And I stopped, and he come up, and his face was vaguely familiar. And he was a guy who'd gone through Cider House 19 years before. And I didn't know what had happened to him. He got clean and sober and left. We didn't know what happened. We got no way of checking up on him or anything. We didn't know where he stayed sober. We got drunk, what he did. And here he is in Minneapolis and telling me about what he's doing there. He is the delegate from the state of Montana to the International Convention. Went through Cider House. That's payday. That's what pays things off. Makes the whole thing worthwhile. So, we had a guy named but he used to say that, I can't even remember what he used to say. Thank you.